This is from Hekigan Roku, Look Leaf Record, case 35. The dialogue of Manjushri and Wucho, the pointer. Determining dragons and snakes, distinguishing jewels and stones, separating the profound and the naive, to settle all uncertainty. If you haven't an eye on your forehead and a talisman under your elbow, time and again, you will miss the point immediately. Right at this very moment, seeing and hearing are not obscured. Sound and form are purely real. Tell me, is it black? Is it white? Is it crooked? Is it straight? At this point, how will you discriminate? The case. Manjushri asked Wucho, "Where have you just come from?" Wucho said, "The south." Manjushri said, "How is the Buddhist teaching being carried on in the south?" Wucho said, "Monks of the last age have little regard for the rules of discipline." Manjushri said, "How numerous are the congregations?" Wucho said, "Some 300, some 500. Wucho asked Manjushri, "How is it being carried on hereabouts?" Manjushri said, "Ordinary people and sages dwell together. Dragons and snakes intermingle." Wucho said, "How numerous are the congregations?" Manjushri said, "In front, 3x3. In back, 3x3. The verse. The thousand peaks twist and turn, the color of indigo. Who says Manjushri was conversing with him? It is laughable how many the people on Qing Liang. In front, 3x3, in back, 3x3. So before we dive into this koan, I'd like to take a moment and remind us all that we are still in the midst of Spring Ango, not counting where we're at. It is the midst of Spring Ango. In terms of formal practice in our lineage, this is a significant part of our training, and as such, it is very meaningful. But whether or not it is still significant in your life is actually purely in your hands. It's not unusual to experience some loosening of the resolve during 3 months training period, regardless of how committed we may feel when it begins. So first, we shouldn't be surprised or bothered by that, by the fact that we lose momentum. No big deal. And then secondly, we should know how to reinvigorate the resolve when it does get whittled down. And it means to fully embrace the practice, which ultimately means to fully embrace your life. Now, Jifu, our diligent head trainee for this Ango, the Shuso, she's been sending weekly emails to encourage, support, and sustain our initial commitments. And also to remind us that impermanence, the theme, is crucially relevant to all of us, practitioners or non-practitioners, having resolve or losing their resolve. It really doesn't matter, right? The theme is still there, as meaningful for all of us. So as the Shuso, Jifu has been honoring her role of being an example practitioner, being of service to others. She's been writing the emails. Are we reading them? Right? Oh, that's all she can do. And that's all her role is about. To offer, to give, to be an example. That's where it ends. In fact, that's where we begin. So she sends the email. At that moment, when she clicks send, the rest is on us. So do we honor our part of it is an important question to work with. In the last email, she mentioned that anger is also impermanent. Not the last from yesterday, but a week ago. So we should not take it for granted and truly take this quickly fleeting an opportunity to deepen our practice, to release the tight grip, to let go a bit, and to nurture the awakening process. Otherwise, we revert to feeding a dormant way of being. If we're not awakening, we're falling asleep. We always nurture some aspect of our lives, but often we are not aware of it, and we are not aware that we are engaged with nurturing harmful habits. So we shouldn't take it for granted, right? Like anything else. Our practice can serve as a neutral flashlight that reveals two capacities. One is the capacity for deep wisdom and compassion, and the other is the capacity for greed, anger, and ignorance. And so it all boils down to one question: which capacity are you cultivating right now? Unfortunately, for all of us, we have found our way to this ancient tradition that can help us develop the ability to discern between those two capacities, so we can learn to nurture what is wise and beneficial and quell the temptation to feed what is ignorant and harmful. It's not the wise people and the ignorant people, as we would like to think about it. It's all in us, within our capacity. And this path is teaching us how to move in alignment with the same wisdom, or it can teach us, how to move in alignment with the same wisdom that makes the trees bloom in the spring and shed leaves in the fall. The same wisdom that functions freely through the formations of mountains and the flow of rivers. And the pointer to this koan begins by examining the ability to discern, determining dragons and snakes, distinguishing jewels and stones, separating the profound and the naive to settle all uncertainty. Dragons and snakes. Now, dragons. A dragon is a depiction of an enlightened being. A snake is a depiction of a deluded being. So this pointer, the beginning of this pointer, is raising two important aspects of practice. The first one is knowing how to be a teacher and distinguish by guiding a student. And secondly, knowing how to be a student. It's not just on the teacher. You know, both require a deep level of commitment. I would even say the same level of commitment. It's not that the teacher should be more committed and the student just tags along. That's not going to work. Both are always equally responsible to keep it alive. The responsibility of a Dharma teacher is to guide from the source and to discern where the student is at and what is needed to bring about further deepening. And then there is the responsibility of being an authentic student and to have the willingness to cut through difficulties and frustrations, to learn to discern between harmful reactivities and constructive receptivity when being guided by a teacher. We don't always hear what we want to hear, but if a teacher-student relationship is nurtured well and correctly, we hear what we need to hear. And often it won't be verbal. Often it will be much more subtle than that. Often it will be offered, but it's up to us to pick up on it, to pay attention to it, right? And how much we pay attention is also a teaching, because if I am self-concerned, very much self-concerned, I'm not going to be able to see the guiding hand or the finger pointing at something, because I am self-absorbed. which is fine. I have that as an option as well, right? But nonetheless, the guiding finger is still pointing. When we are ready to be less self-concerned, or willing to be less self-concerned or absorbed, then we open the eye. Oh yeah, there it is. Okay, now I know what to look at. What to look at. The pointer continues, if you haven't an eye on your forehead and a talisman under your elbow, time and again you will miss the point. Now the eye on the forehead is the eye that cuts 2 to 1. And the talisman on is a stone on the elbow, is a stone that or ring that Taoist masters used to wear under the elbow to gain magical powers. In Zen, this is what's equated in Zen to that is, you know, seeing through the eye on the forehead makes you realize that the magic, the true magic that we speak of, lies in eating, drinking, laughing, crying, living and dying. Going through everyday affairs without a shred of hesitation. That's where magic comes up. That's where it comes from. Not differentiating, not holding on to this and wanting to reject that. And this is what the pointer is asking us to see. It says, right at this very moment, seeing and hearing are not obscured. Sound and form are purely real. Tell me, is it black? Is it white? Is it crooked? Is it straight? Now, direct interaction with reality, as we often speak about, is available to all. But it appears to be obscured because we get entangled in our own fixed designations. In other words, we get entangled by ourselves in ourselves. But how do we know that the crooked is not straight? And where is the dividing line between black and white or any other perceived opposites? And what about enlightenment and delusion? What separates those two? As Zen practitioners, we need to examine our many undergo on a moment-by-moment basis our many fixed ideas about reality. Any fixed idea about reality. As soon as it arises in the mind, we need to take that flashlight of wisdom and direct it at that so we can see through that. We can see through what seems to first appear to be solid and fixed and substantiated. So this is where magic comes to life. When you take that flashlight and you shine it through, you see how transparent you and your ideas are. You see how alive you are, actually. It's phenomenal. And to truly understand, when it comes to impermanence, to truly understand impermanence means to cut through all those fixed notions of dualities, any fixedness. And fixedness becomes most poisonous when it raises a notion of duality and a dividing line between them. This is what leads to our craziness or the atrocities we leave behind. So to cut through all those fixed notions of dualities and then acknowledge that everything and everyone is constantly changing by nature. So if it is, how can my ideas or me be different? And if we understand reality in such a way, then how do we use discernment, right? It's not to use discernment, obviously, but the question is, how do we use discernment when we understand that nothing is fixed? And this is where the pointer ends with that question. At this point, how will you discriminate? And again, the word discrimination is not a negative. We have negative connotation to it, obviously. But discrimination, in this case, means discernment, the ability to discern. So what happens to our ability to discern when we realize that all things are essentially impermanent, empty, and one, then how do we function? The dialogue in this koan is somewhat unusual, since the two characters did not actually live during the same historical time. Manjushri and Wucho. Manjushri was a historical figure at the time of the Buddha, and his image is a representation of wisdom, as you can see right there, right? On the lion. He is called the teacher of the seven Buddhas, but what is really meant by that is that he's the teacher at the source, the teacher within you. So what we see here on the altar is actually a mirror that should reflect to us the wisdom within, the teacher within. Wucho lived during the 7th century in China around the same time as Huineng, the sixth ancestor. At least this is what we know based on recorded history. So this encounter begins at the time Wucho was visiting Mount Wutai, which was known as the sacred dwelling place of Manjushri. When he came to a barren area on the mountain, Manjushri suddenly appeared and produced a temple to take him in for the night. Then he asked Wucho, "Where have you just come from?" And Wucho said, "The south." And the footnote under that line says, "There is nothing outside the great vastness. Why is there nonetheless a south?" Because there is. Now remember, so connect this with the question from the pointer. How do you use discernment when you realize that nothing is fixed and everything is interconnected? So that's the clue to look at that. Manjushri then asked, "How is the Buddhist teaching being carried on in the south?" And Wucho said, "Monks of this last age have little regard for the rules of discipline." Manjushri asked, "How numerous are the congregations?" And Wucho said, "Some 300, some 500. You can adjust position if you need. So let's go back to that line. "Monks of this last age have little regard for the rules of discipline." This is as relevant as it gets when we look at how we function as society and also how we as wisdom practitioners regard the Dharma. We look at the state of our world. There's no question about the urgent need to turn towards Dharma teachings and wisdom and to maintain strong practice. But are we actually doing it? How do we regard the rules of discipline? Now, to our unruly minds, discipline may appear as an obstacle or threat to its existence. "Don't tell me what to do," it says. Who is it saying it to? Right? It's as if we have an inner toddler who is in charge of navigating our lives, pushing back against any sense of structure or discipline. Lacking spiritual maturity, this inner toddler says, "I want to do whatever I want whenever I choose to do it." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Which we often obey, and then we confuse it as a way to achieve freedom. "I am free because I do whatever I want whenever I want to do it." Is that freedom? Now, part of our ongoing practice is to recognize and accept this undeveloped energy within us and learn to apply discipline in a way that is gentle, supple, and sustained. And loving, too. In the beginning of Sesshin, I spoke a little bit about the importance of cultivating and maintaining a sense of gentle discipline, a phrase which may first sound somewhat contradictory. But when we actually put this into practice, we realize that a gentle approach can help us greatly sustain a discipline in a more realistic way. And also it can strengthen our resolve, since the practice becomes more all-inclusive and accepting. In other words, resisting resistance only will result in further resistance, right? So not pushing against that which is pushing. And cultivating this kind of discipline is very helpful during Sesshin, obviously, because it's highly structured, but is also relevant to all other aspects of formal practice and essentially to the way we live our lives. Right, so to be disciplined now, so you know, we actually do understand discipline in terms of, for example, wanting to achieve some promotion or wanting to achieve goals. We know that we have to be disciplined, but this is a different kind of discipline. This is not a discipline that has a later in it. This is a discipline that has only now in it. So it's a goalless kind of discipline. It's not, if I'll be disciplined for this amount of months and years, I will achieve this or that. That's already stained. What we're talking about is be disciplined now about now. So what does that mean? Right? So in case you're still separating between formal practice and everyday life, it will be good to know that Zen training is not for the purpose of becoming better Zen students or advance in some idea of Zen ranks. That's not the point. Never been the point. It is more about realizing reality as it really is and learn to be in alignment with it so we can naturally be authentic and lead a wholesome and beneficial life. In other words, be true to who we are, who we really are. So how do we do that? How do we do it now that summer is around the corner? We may have some plans to go on vacation, take some time for R&R with family and friends, which is a great opportunity to actually take a break and slow down. But at the same time, at the same token, this can be a great opportunity to deepen your Zen life integration and recognize that what we call practice has no shape, form, or definition. It shows up wherever you happen to be, and it takes the shape of whatever you happen to be doing. So essentially, there's never a break from what we consider continuous practice. Even when you put your feet up and do nothing, practice it. And that goes to all circumstances in our lives. All circumstances are not obstacles to the practice unless we define them as such. Then they are. They become that immediately. I cannot practice because, or I need a break from practice because, here's what's happening. Well, who is telling you that the crooked is not straight? I have an idea of practice. It looks like this. My life is not like that right now. Therefore, that's defining. That's fixating. That's creating complications. Whatever is happening is what we practice. So our great challenge is to recognize this and gracefully go through the changing seasons of our lives, externally and internally, while not neglecting to nurture the three treasures, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So we have to ask, how do I nurture the three treasures now that I'm dealing with circumstances I definitely don't want? Right? Whether it's emotional, physical, health-related issues, family-related issues, financial-related issues, whatever, job-related issues, all of it is an obstacle only if we choose to define it as such. And again, it all comes down to you. When your practice, all of it, when your practice falls apart, this wisdom tradition falls apart. It's a big responsibility. When your practice is maintained, this wisdom tradition thrives. Because wisdom will never fall apart, but the tradition can disintegrate. Which is why when I mentioned that the responsibility of a teacher and two students are the same, that's what I meant by that. And this is the responsibility, to maintain the wisdom tradition because we care. Because we care. Not about the wisdom tradition, because we care about each other, because we care about life. So then, would you ask Manjushri, how is it being carried on hereabouts? And this is here, right? How do we carry on our practice? Manjushri said, ordinary people and sages dwell together, dragons and snakes intermingle. And this is very fitting, again. Practitioners, as you know, as we all know, often express challenges of keeping their practice alive while functioning among non-practitioners. Right, we go to Sishin and it may be great, right? It's a challenge, obviously, but it may be great because we're all there with the same kind of mindset, right? We come in, we know what it's about, and we roll up our sleeves and we do the practice. And it's great because it does nurture something very important in us. But then Sishin ends. And then we drive down the mountain, and then we have to deal with all these people that appear to be an obstacle to my practice. Are they an obstacle to my practice, or are they mirroring to me what I don't want to see in me? Because that's what it is. They're not them. I'm not me. I am them, and they are me. So if I do realize something, I have a responsibility to mirror this to others. And if I see something in another, before I rush to judge it, I have to realize that that is mirroring something to me that I have in me. How do you separate? When we understand that this is like that. And it's true that most of our lives we spend with people who are not practicing, right? They did not choose to be a part of a wisdom tradition. But it is equally true that a precious jewel is not more than a stone, right? So what we perceive to be not it is equally it, although it does not look like it. It may not shine, but it is still precious. It may need some honing. We may need some honing, some polishing. But when do we not? When do we stop that? When do we get to a point that we don't need polishing? So a true dragon does not reject its own snakehood. Snakeness, whatever you want to make of it. Manjushri uses the words dwell together and intermingle, which is referring to the way wisdom functions, living in the realm of duality, yet not being blind to unity at every step. So whatever is going on, whoever we happen to be with, it is always teaching us. Wisdom is always there. We can open the eyes, close the eyes. We can separate. We can realize that we dwell together. We intermingle. Now, we have to know that it begins with us, right? So it's not just us versus other, us and others, right? So we have all those kinds of energies within us. And we have to understand that those energies actually dwell together. The wisdom in us and the craziness and stupidity in us actually dwell together. So we have to learn to be compassionate with ourselves and realize that we have the same craziness we often complain about. and acknowledge that. Because if we really acknowledge that we have, that's what we are complaining about, won't that make us a lot more compassionate with others? Right? Our own internal dragons and snakes, delusion and realization, meeting others with their own internal dragons and snakes, right? That's all the same. And the other thing which we have to always keep in mind in this is karma. Everybody has to deal with karma. Most of which is unknown to all of us. So we like to complain, we like to point fingers, but then we don't know, neither does the other often, why do we act the way we act? Something is moving us to say what we say, to think what we think, to act the way we act. It doesn't mean that there are no consequences. Obviously, there are consequences. But at least we have to keep in mind that karma is always there operating in the background. And we are compelled to act in all kinds of crazy ways because it is acting in the background often. So now, non-practitioners, right, when we're not practicing, well, often that's the way it goes. That's the way we experience our lives. But for a practitioner, yes, the same, that's the way I experience my life. But the difference is when it arises in me, I actually take a look at it. Or the practice is telling me, take a look at it. Watch before you speak, before you act. Be careful. Because it wants you to say something, but is that what needs to be said? Is the question. So as practitioners, we actually take the time to observe, right? Unobserved mind, unobserved thoughts lead to unobserved words and unobserved actions. Observed mind leads to different kinds of words and actions. Because we may see it arising in the mind and say, I don't want to say that. Because if I say it, I know what's going to happen. I know the direction it's going to go. I know the harm it's going to cause. I don't want to do it. That's the difference. Karma is karma. There's no way out of it. There's no way around it. But an awakened practitioner recognizes karma. An awakened practitioner does not for a second think that karma will vanish. And also does not demand that karma will vanish. Right? Karma can stick around. How do we meet it is the question, or the power. Another thing is very important when we talk about cultivating deep level of commitment, or discernment, commitment, and discipline, is unconditional patience, which I also mentioned at the beginning of Sishin. To never stop cultivating unconditional patience, regardless of what happens, regardless of how pissed off we may be or irritated we may be, never stop cultivating. Well, that's the best time, actually. The more pissed off we are, the better the opportunity to cultivate unconditional patience. Because if you're not pissed off, well, yeah, I got a lot of patience for you because you're not bothering me today. I can even smile. And I came across an article about, this is actually Kshanti Paramita, is the perfection of forbearance and patience. So I came across an article about that by Norman Fisher, and I want to bring it up and to stress the vital importance of this practice, right? The practice of patience, cultivating patience. He says, the perfection of patience is transformative. It transforms difficult circumstances from misfortune or disasters into spiritual benefits. Right? And everything and anything can actually be practiced in such a way. It may appear to be a misfortune, but if we know how to meet it, it can actually transform it and use it to deepen our practice rather than say, I cannot practice now because of this. For this reason, it is particularly powerful practice, a prized and essential one. A person who develops it has strength of character, vision, courage, dignity, and depth. You may change position, adjust. She or he understands something profound about human beings and how to love them. Right? Understands something profound about human beings and how to love them. And when we truly turn the attention inwardly, we actually can study that on a momentary basis. Watch our irritations, examine what we experience, and realize everybody goes through that. Everybody gets pissed off. Everybody feels intense anger at different times. Everybody contracts. So when we understand something profound about human beings, he says, then we know how to love them. I'm using perfection of patience, he says, to denote Santi Paramita, because we are so profoundly impatient about everything these days. We can use a dose of old-fashioned patience. Patience is the most important of all the bodhisattva practices, because without it, all the others will eventually fail. And the practice will also fall apart. Practice tradition will fall apart. It is easy enough to practice meditation, generosity, ethical conduct, those are the other paramitas, and the other wonderful practices when things are going smoothly. But when things fall apart, as they inevitably do from time to time, we revert to old patterns. So I said before, if we don't practice wisdom, we practice delusion. We practice habits. Over the years, many people have told me they regret that they haven't been tending to their spiritual practice lately, but they can't right now. They're having some personal setbacks and will get back to their practice as soon as things clear up. What they haven't understood is that difficult times are the most fruitful time for spiritual practice, because they are exactly when the practice of patience comes most into play. When things get tough, you should intensify rather than set aside your practice. So the old saying of Gandhi, today I'm very busy, I have a lot going on, I'm going to sit twice as long. What do we say? No, I'm busy, I can't meditate today. Flip it. Flip it upside down. Get yourself to the cushion and sit. But I don't have time. Really? Look again. And I know for this I'm going to get a lot of heat from a lot of people. Because I do. Because people then tell me, yeah, but you don't understand my situation. Well, I don't have to. You do. I live my life, you live your life. We have different circumstances. That doesn't mean we can't practice. Because if that was the case, there will be no practice for us to inherit. How do we inherit a practice and then pass it on to others if that's what we think? Because people before us had tough times and found a way to maintain the practice and give it to us today. How did they do that? They have much easier time than us. You can look. You will see. In fact, actually, if you read the Zen Chinese Heritage, right, Ferguson's book, you will see the short description and chapter about a lot of the teachers, and you will see the hardship and difficulties they went through before they became teachers, before they realized, before they passed on the Dharma to their successors. They went through hell. But they stayed on the path. They kept it alive. Which means we have to let that mirror something to us. Then he says, Norman Fisher says, it's natural to turn away in the face of difficulty. We come by this powerful habit honestly. No one wants to go towards pain. We want to go elsewhere, take a break, think of something else, get rid of it if we can. We distract, deny, blame, or rush around generally futile attempts to fix it somehow. With the practice of patience, we train ourselves to do the opposite, to turn toward the difficulty and embrace it as an ally. And this is the point, right? To turn towards, not judge, not say, I want something else, I want a different reality. Well, obviously, yes, we get it, is what he's saying, right? You want a different reality? Well, yes. If it's painful, why would you want pain? But when we want a different reality, then what happens? Then it becomes an obstacle. But when we turn towards it, realizing, yeah, that I don't want it, right? But we turn towards it nonetheless, embrace it fully, then it actually becomes fuel and fodder for the practice. So work with that. Don't blame me for saying that. Wucho said, how numerous are the congregations? Manjushri said, in front 3x3, in back 3x3. And the footnote to that says, crazy words, insane talk. But tell me, how many are they? Even the great compassionate one with 1,000 hands could not count them all. We chant, human beings are numberless. Numberless. Still, I vow to save them. Now that we understand this, how do you take on a task which seems completely unrealistic? I need to count to figure out if I can do this. How many are they? By dealing with such questions through verbal gymnastics or intellectual way will not work. So ask that question and work with that. After the exchange in this koan, apparently the two of them sat down to have some tea. Manjushri held up a crystal ball and asked, do they also have this in the south? Could you close the window? Thank you. So he held it up and he asked, do they also have this in the south? And Chu said, no. Manjushri said, what do they usually use to drink tea? Chu was speechless. After that, he decided to leave and Manjushri ordered Chun Ti, the attendant, to see him to the gate. When they got to the gate, Wucho asked the attendant. Before, he said, in front 3x3, in back 3x3, how many is that? The attendant said, all worthy. Chu responded, yes. The attendant says, how many is this? This is bringing it right to the point. This calling and answering, right there at that meeting. Oh, worthy. Yes. Yes. Then how many is this? Right there, everything reveals itself. Nothing is missing. And if you go there, you got patience for eons, for everyone. But he didn't get it. So, how many is this? So then he asked, what temple is this? Right? So, okay, well, let me come up with a different question. The attendant pointed beyond the direction of the temple. When Chu turned his head, the illusory temple and the attendant had all vanished completely out of sight. As before, it was just an empty valley. And up to this point, Wucho did not know that the teacher he met at this place was a manifestation of Manjushri. That's why he asked the attendant, what temple is that? He also asked, What is the meaning of in front 3x3, in back 3x3? Right? So those are good pointers to look at. When all things return to the one returns to all things. Then everything is settled. Nothing is obscured. So this temple, along with Manjushri and the attendant, vanished without a trace. Did it exist? Was it a dream? Think about the stuff that bothered you yesterday, a year ago, 5 years ago. Think about how bothered you were, upside down completely. Where is it now? All the craziness about it, and I was like, well, it's okay. Now I have something else going on, or something else to be bothered by. Where does it come from? Where does it go? We do turn upside down. We get deep groove right between the eyes. About what? So based on what we know, Wucho was most likely a Dharma heir of Nyutui, who succeeded to Daojin, the fourth patriarch. And I would like to actually finish with this few words from Daojin, who said, the 100,000 gates of the Buddha Dharma, they all return to this mind, the source of the countless exquisite sublime practices is this mind. The all-inclusive mind. All of the precepts and monastic rules, Zen meditation, Dharma gates of knowledge and wisdom, and every sort of miraculous manifestation are your natural possession. Not separate from your mind, every type of nuisance and karmic impediment is fundamentally empty and without real existence. Every type of nuisance. Every type of karmic impediment. All causes and effects are but illusions. There are no three worlds to cast off. There is no body that can be attained. The original nature and appearance of what is human and what is non-human does not differ. The great way is empty and vast without a single thought. If you have attained this Dharma, where nothing whatsoever is lacking, what difference is there between yourself and Buddha, between snakes and dragons? When there is not a single teaching left, then you are just left to abide in your own nature. So cast off all teaching. Cast off everything. With no need to worry about your behavior, no need to practice cleansing austerities, but just living a life without desires, with a mind without anger, without cares, completely at ease, and without impediments, acting according to your own will, without needing to take on any good or evil affairs, just walking, abiding, sitting, lying down, with whatever meets your eye, being nothing other than the essential source. And all of it is but the sublime function of Buddha, blissful and without care. This is called Buddha. All of it. All of it. So please cultivate patience for all of it. Thank you. So, finish.
respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by, and opportunity is lost. Each of us must strive to awaken. Awaken. Take heed. Do not squander your life.